Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, movie reviews galore as we critique the latest DVD releases, including Cassandra's Dream, Diary of the Dead, and the new Rambo box set, followed by an in-depth discussion on the Rambo legacy with one of the leading film commentators on the internet, Mr. Matt Zoller-Seitz. And then we welcome author and instructor Pamela J. Smith as she discusses her new book, The Power of the Dark Side, before finally delivering our roundtable reviews on the latest Indiana Jones adventure. I know you can't wait for that one. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. This is Movie Geeks United. I am Jamie, and we are joined the first part of tonight's show by Jerry, as always. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
And by Aaron. I'm sorry.
You want me to go ahead and give you the winners of Cannes this year? Or?
Oh, yeah, we'll need to get into that. Yeah. And Aaron's here with us, too. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, fellas, what's up?
Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
We're going to talk a little bit about Cannes. We're going to do some DVD reviews. Then we're going to bring on a very special guest, Matt Zoller-Seitz, to discuss the Rambo legacy. We're going to talk about a great new book about writing terrific villainous characters. And then we're going to talk about the new Indiana Jones film, and we're going to bring on Chris for that last segment. That'll be a really kind of spirited discussion that we're all looking forward to.
That's going to be historic.
It will be. Join us in the chat room if you haven't already. If you're out there listening, just click the chat available logo up there. It'll direct you directly to our chat room and join in on the discussion, the movie geek talk in there. It's always a lot of fun. If you have any comments or questions or anything, you can give us a call at 718-508-9477. Let's hear about Cannes. What you got there?
Well, I just know I pulled up a page, and it looks like a French movie, The Class, won the Palme d'Or. I know nothing about this movie. All I know is that it screened on the last day of the festival,
but
it got high marks across the board.
The director, he did a couple of really good films that have got a lot of praise. I don't know if you all know the movies, Human Resources and Time
That's
Out.
A good film. That's a very good film.
So this is
it's a French film, The Class?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it's on Laurent Cantet. How do you pronounce it, Aaron?
Content. Yeah. I think contempt might be because it's
Well, it's interesting because just reading through a couple of nights ago, I mean, they it was a big question mark. You know, what's going to win this year? It was really up in the air, and nothing really stunned people. I mean, there are a couple of titles that they were impressed by, but nothing that really bowled him over. So that's very telling that one of the last days, the movie that screens on the last day, picks up the Palme d'Or.
Yeah, one of the ones that I am very interested in, that won the Grand Prix, is an Italian film, Gomorrah, which is about the Naples organized crime, which the director had described as an anti-Sopranos. It doesn't glamorize organized crime. And that won the Grand Prix, so I'm very curious to see that one.
Yeah, you know all the talk, though, about that people were afraid that given the jury this year led by Sean Penn and featuring, you know, Natalie Portman, and who else was on the panel this year? The judging panel.
Is Roman Polanski, was he on the...
No,
I think Del Toro. Was Del Toro on it?
Del Toro, I think...
No, Del Toro, was he on it? Was Guillermo Del Toro on it?
I think he was Guillermo del Toro, yes, I think he was.
The other big, I guess you could say, name on the jury was the director of Persepolis. And
right.
who
mm-hmm, that's right.
Who, like Sean Penn, has a very, you know, unique, very individualistic political point of view. And there were some bloggers who speculated that if, you know, if there was going to be any kind of battles in the jury room, it was going to be between Sean Penn and her, because they both have very contrasting political viewpoints.
So. Yeah, it's interesting though because they were rumored that, you know, they're thinking maybe they'll favor an American film, the leading contender of which was the Eastwood film, The Changeling.
Mm-hmm.
Which did Angelina Jolie win the Actress Prize for that? Because that
no, what happened?
No, she did not.
But what happened? This is curious, and this has been going on for some time now, is that they created a special, as they call it, 61st, you know, Cannes Film Festival Award. Now they did this with Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine.
Yeah, Award of Distinction. Yeah,
Award of Distinction, and here they gave out two. One was for Catherine Deneuve. She's in a movie called A Christmas Tale.
That's right.
Pretty remarkable. And the other one, and of course, the other person who got this award was Clint Eastwood for his body of work. So that's how they kind of honored Clint Eastwood. And they also honored, because everyone was also thinking, well, is Sean Penn going to go for the very overtly political Shay? And they didn't do that because
go over well.
It got very mixed reviews, but they did give the apparently unanimous Best Actor award did go to Benicio del Toro for best. So they did give it that. And so I am curious about Shay. My gut feeling, having not seen it but having done a lot of reading, my gut feeling, since it does not have an American distributor yet, is that Soderbergh is going to have to synthesize the two films into 1 3-hour film, and then DVD will allow him to give us that 4.5-hour, you know,
Criterion release, maybe.
Yeah, something like that. That is my gut feeling, that he's going to have to synthesize the film to about 3 hours at the most.
Well,
because I don't visualize a back-to-back, a 3-month separated, you know, kind of back-to-back art house run.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's a possibility. But it's a $65 million project, and they say the way it's told, it's very uniquely told. Some people say far ahead of its time, actually.
Yeah.
The actual people that praise it, I mean, praise it to the heavens. I mean, they absolutely think it's remarkable.
Well, let's put it like this. I think it's much better. I know for a fact it's much better than the Shay movie that was made with Omar Sharif a long time ago. Okay, so let's just keep that in perspective. It's a good movie. If you're going to compare it to the Sharif one, this is light years ahead of it.
And I'm going to go, I think I was not a big fan of Motorcycle Diaries, frankly. So I'm going to say it's probably even better than Motorcycle Diaries.
That's a fair. I like Motorcycle Diaries, but I could see this is really this is going to be the definitive film.
Right.
About
and
him.
And obviously the complaint that a lot of critics had, and this is usually a complaint of very liberal kind of moralistic critics, is that it omits, if you will, the kind of torture, persecutor section of Shay's, you know, reign in Cuba, and that is not depicted here. And I feel that, having not seen the film, my feelings are usually with this type of stuff, is that it has to be judged on what the director shows you. And the fact that that is not depicted and that stuff is omitted, to me, that doesn't seem to be that big of a problem because we all know that that's true. So
right. It's
kind of like, you know, the movie Max. Remember the movie Max with John Cusack?
I thought that was a good movie.
That is a very interesting movie, and it is a unique film. I mean, we all know what Hitler did, you know, so critics seem to sometimes, they get worried that, well, we need to make sure the audience knows that he's also a bad person. I don't feel that is necessarily the case in biographical.
Yeah, but at the same time, I appreciate filmmakers that choose to show warts and all and leave it to you to make your decision. I mean, this isn't the best comparison, but Ralph Fiennes' character in Schindler's List, he, in spite of his best instincts, he formed some kind of bond with the Helen Hirsch character.
Right.
And yet, it's still honest enough to show you this guy's a devil. I mean, you know, he's friendly with Schindler. He's got his certain charms, but he still does target practice from the balcony of his hotel.
Well,
you know, There's some bravery in showing warts and all
you have to. If you want to make a good movie, a balanced movie, but if you want to make, you have to show the bad side, because or else, you know, you don't have anything.
Because isn't it a form of propaganda if you don't?
I wouldn't say that because, I mean, you got to ask yourself how much did the movie Schindler's List kind of clean up the image of Oscar Schindler. And the same thing with Larry Flint and the People versus Larry Flint.
Yeah, but that was a complaint about Schindler's List, yeah.
That was a complaint at the time among a lot of American Jews and a lot of – was that it did not – you know, he was not as – how should we say it? Well, he was not as charismatic as Liam Neeson,
mm-hmm.
and he was not as good. But that is a problem. But I think and what was the other movie you brought up, The People versus Larry Flint?
Yeah.
There is an argument to be made that when that movie came out, I liked that movie, but I do realize, and it also coincided with the release of his autobiography,
mm-hmm.
he paints him out to be he paints himself out to be a champion of the First Amendment,
mm-hmm.
and everything else is supposed to be glossed over. Well,
see, at the same time, I didn't get that sense from Larry Flint though that it whitewashed who he was.
Yeah, because he does. I mean, you know, you could say he's. I don't care who you are. You could from the movie at least, you could say, you know, he's a sleazy son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the one I'd go with.
And he revels in that. That's part of his charm in that movie.
That is what
actually makes
him look. I used to live next door to the Flint building. Okay, trust me, I know. Yes.
I've been to the Flint store in L.A. That was close enough for me. They have the footprints and the footprints and the handprints. They had another kind of print from John Holmes in the entry of the Flint store in L.A.
Can I ask you? Would you want it any other way?
What a grand entrance!
I understand
though.
The thing about Shea. I mean, the most recent cinematic version, and it's not a big part, but was in Andy Garcia's The Lost City. And that has a rather negative view of Che Guevara.
And The Lost City is a lost film. It's a really good film. Flawed as it is. I mean,
it's flawed, but it is a very entertaining, engrossing film.
Yeah.
I would expect nothing less. I think Andy Garcia is one of our most compassionate actors. I still haven't checked it out, but
very Coppola-like. See, he really picked up stuff working from Francis on Godfather 3. It's got a lot of great little moments in it.
Too bad he didn't find a way to incorporate the decapitation scene from Black Rain. Which is always my favorite Andy Garcia movie.
Damn, it's harsh.
Speaking of decapitation, we have some... that's not a good segue at all.
That is a good segue.
Some of our DVDs this week actually involve lots of carnage and decapitations.
All of them, I think, too.
Yeah, except let's go Woody Allen, our first one. I have some definite thoughts about this one. Cassandra's Dream, which as a DVD, it's really unfair to review a Woody Allen film in relation to its DVD release, because anyone out there that loves DVDs, you love them for the extras, and you never get any extras on a Woody Allen DVD.
Did we even get the trailer this time? I can't remember. Did we get?
We get nothing. We get subtitles.
Okay.
That's hey, as being someone in the subtitling and captioning business, that's important.
Oh yeah, well I understand for a selective slice of the populace, yeah. But Cassandra's Dream is actually. As a film, so we can only really review it as a film. It was a real revelation to me as a Woody Allen fan. I wasn't expecting anything from it because I'd read the lukewarm reviews on it, and I found a lot of pleasure in it. And if you see it, and Jerry, I went back and read your review of it. I think it's dead on in that this works as a trilogy of sorts for Woody Allen,
mm-hmm.
between Crimes and Misdemeanors, Match Point, and Cassandra's Dream, where, you know, the moral boundaries are crossed, a crime
mm-hmm.
is committed. Crimes and Misdemeanors kind of hinted that, you know, you can get over anything.
Right.
Match Point kind of hinted that with a little bit of luck, you can get out of anything. This one presents a similar quandary, and yet it plays it as a straight tragedy,
Greek tragedy. I mean, real.
I think so too. I think the last scene or so of it kind of cops out a little bit. I think it still maintains a kind of power, and I think mostly because Ewan McGregor and Colin Farrell work so well together. And Colin Farrell just gets better
and
better every film.
Can we say that Ewan McGregor and Colin Farrell, that you know, it's amazing that it took them this long to pair up. That I really want to see them in another film.
Yes.
I would want to see them, you know, as crass as some of my taste. I would love to see them in like a cop buddy film. You know,
I'd like to see them in a comedy, actually.
Yeah,
because they're both hysterical people.
I mean, imagine them. I mean, you just plug them into any dual. I mean, imagine them like doing like Irish Scottish Midnight Run or Heat. You know, I would just love this. You know, there's a Saturday Night Live skit to be done of those two guys doing the De Niro Pacino scene in Heat. I mean,
I can see at the same time people watching this movie not necessarily being fans of Woody Allen or perhaps not fans of his later work and thinking that it's another kind of droll, slow film. But for me, I'm looking at Woody Allen a little differently now. This is a guy who's written so many screenplays, directed so many movies. He produces. I mean, he just one after another.
Mm-hmm.
He has a joy of writing. So I kind of judge it by the fact that he sits down, he writes a screenplay. Are the characters interesting? Does he pull off a strong, sturdy story? Is it well told? That's my kind of criteria now. It doesn't have to blow me over the moon anymore. Woody Allen, this is a good, strong story with characters that you empathize with. And, I mean, that's where it works. It's a good, strong movie.
And I like to say, I have a theory that on certain films, depending on when, and it's not a mind-blowing theory, that depending on when they release, that they're not going to get the fair reviews I think they deserve. I feel in the fact that Cassandra's Dream came out in this kind of January, February of the year, I get the feeling that critics sometimes, because of Sundance and because of Oscar season, and they're used to most of the stuff being released around that time, not being, quote-unquote, just kind of, you know, bad and just dumping ground stuff, that they kind of just ignore this stuff. And so I get the feeling that if Cassandra's Dream had been saved for the fall or maybe the late summer, like August, it would have gotten a little more consideration from critics because it is not the 1980s when Woody Allen was at his peak. Where
I think I know why. It was pushed back from its fall release because Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the
too
similarities.
Similar, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, because they're really different films in the end.
Yeah, because, you know, back in the 80s, you know, Radio Days and Hannah and Her Sister, they were like February, March releases, and, of course, you know, those films were remembered come Oscar time, but Woody Allen is not in that peak form anymore, at least critic-wise. So I get the feeling that kind of hurt him here. Because it's a small film, but it is a good story.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and it's well told. So we would both recommend it. If this project appeals to you, pick it up. I think you'll be pleased with it.
I think if you liked Match Point, if you're interested by his later stuff or even but his like more serious films, I think it's definitely worth checking out.
I don't think of it as very somber because I think the performances feel so alive in it. And plus, I think it's important to note that Aaron, you're talking about release dates and stuff. I think Woody Allen's movies would be greater, more appreciated if he only made one every 2 or 3 years.
Right.
Yeah, we're getting another one at the end of the summer.
Yeah, yeah. We have someone on the line, his screen name, Faristacat. Faristacat, you're on the air. Faristacat?
Hello?
Hey.
Hello?
You're breaking up. I guess you're on your headset.
Okay. Hello?
I'm sorry, man. You're breaking up. I can't hear you, buddy.
I can't hear him either.
But that is a new feature, and stunningly illustrated with that first attempt, you can actually, if you have a headset, you can actually click on the click to talk icon on the top of the screen, and it will connect you directly to our show. No phone call needed. So, Faristacat, I'm sorry, your connection isn't that great. I can only hear spurts here and there. We got a couple more DVDs to review before we bring on our first guest, so let's do these quickly. I'll do mine because I got something in the mail that I wanted to discuss just very briefly, and it's for any hardcore fan of Dario Argento, the Italian master of horror, who's actually working on a new film now with Adrian Brody as his star and executive producer. That's going to be an interesting one.
That should be very interesting.
And whose film Mother of Tears is coming out this summer. But this is a collection of five films of his, including Do You Like Hitchcock, Trauma, Phenomena, The Card Player, and I'm sorry, Tenebrae? Tenebrae.
Tenebrae.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are all, it's very reasonable. Five films, very nice metal package. And, you know, if you like Dario Argento, I mean, you can't not own it. I mean, his vision is in full force here, and everything that you like about him is represented in these five films, some of which are lesser known than others. But they're great films. I can't say that they're necessarily my cup of tea, all of them. But I can see why he has a following, actually.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
And can we say that before we start getting some hate mail or hate emails, that by us highlighting Dario Argento, we are in no way saying that we prefer Argento to Mario Bava. We are fans of both.
Yeah, I'm fans of both of them, for
usually,
sure.
In the horror community, it's either a either-or to Bava.
Right,
or
right.
Yeah, you're right.
We don't want to start that.
I believe this comes out as does Cassandra's Dream this Tuesday.
Yes.
And now onto our next horror movie title, Aaron. If you want to take the lead on this,
okay,
Diary of the Dead.
George A. Romero's Diary of the Dead, and it is. I don't know if you did this intentionally. I do find it interesting that we are reviewing Diary of the Dead on the same show that we're reviewing Cassandra's Dream, because I have a theory that George A. Romero's zombie films are to the horror fans what the latest Woody Allen film is, and that basically only the converted go to every Romero film, every zombie film, every pseudo-political satire that Romero has, you know, kind of wrought with his zombie film. In the same way that for a time that I'm sure even now, every, you know, there's a certain group who go to every Woody Allen film no matter what. And
yeah.
While I think the Woody Allen fandom has kind of cooled and it's a little more selective, I think George A. Romero in his later years, oddly enough, has now reached the point where Woody Allen used to be. And the thing is, Diary of the Dead is, as far as the attacks go, the zombie attacks, they're as brutal and as funny and as exciting as they've ever been. The fact is that Romero seems to have now reached a point where he thinks everything can be painted in terms of we're all zombies, be it YouTube, be it Homeland Security, be it consumerism, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Diary of the Dead does not really hold much weight politically. It's just a zombie film. And frankly, I think this cycle of zombie films that we've had for the last 4 or 5 years has really starting to come to an end, and I think the peak really was the Dawn of the Dead remake and Shaun of the Dead, which were kind of the mirror image of each other. And Land of the Dead was kind of fun and nostalgic way.
And then you have your 28 Days and 28 Weeks Later.
Yeah, your
28
Days,
too.
28 Weeks
yeah.
Later. And frankly, the Romero stuff seems a little like a also ran, you know, a little passe.
Yeah. With me. And Aaron, you and I talked about this. I frankly, in the end, it's a zombie movie.
Mm-hmm.
I frankly think it's ridiculous how he's throwing every social, political issue into this genre. And it's amazing to me how none of it even remotely sticks this time for me.
It's kind of funny.
Immigration, all the way down
right.
the line. It's like a laundry list. And it's a zombie movie. It's too much. Just, you know, the movie works best when you have the simple, quote-unquote, pleasures of the concept. Your parents, your brother, your family could come out and they could start to eat you. I mean, that's when it works. The primal. And
right.
he forgets
well, I think
that.
Those
you know,
scenes, I think those scenes work. But I also, I mean, I think this, and I know I'm like one of like maybe five people like Land of the Dead, I do think his political stuff works. It's overkill in Diary of the Dead. You get it within the first like five minutes of the film. And
it kind of 40 years ago.
He hits it over the head. He hits it over the head in this one. But I think there's some things that work very well in Diary of the Dead. But I think Aaron made a very good analogy. He is what he is to what Woody Allen. That's a very good analogy.
And here's the other thing, is that like what we've seen with De Palma and his brace of DV with Redacted, and apparently what Schrader has said on our show, what he wants to do with the DV and the internet and using that as for film, is that on one hand I'm glad that now Romero with this film with you know taking kind of the Blair Witch / Cloverfield approach to the home video and the digital, and I on one hand I'm excited that these directors are embracing that, but on the other hand they seem to be forgetting that just because the form is not the most important thing, in that they seem to be so excited by the quickness and speed that this new technology seems to be affording them that they're sacrificing simple yet elemental things for a film to work. You know, in Redacted, you know, De Palma lost all track of, like, getting a halfway coherent, decent, naturalistic performance, and the same thing here with Romero. It's always been a kind of
hallmark. I think
hallmark.
This works a lot better than Redacted.
It's been a hallmark that Romero's used unknowns and has gotten these kind of, you know, kind of bland but very naturalistic performances, and both Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead have that. But ever since Dawn of the Dead, starting with Day of the Dead, these non-professional, you know, local actors that he's gotten from Pittsburgh, they really haven't measured up.
Oh,
and
God, we're going to get hate mail from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, that's the last place we want hate mail from. You know, the point is, I think that he still got it. He still got some lead in the pencil, so to speak. So
I hope I have some lead in the pencil, Betty.
Just get away from the zombie movies for a little while. You know, try your hand at something else for a while.
No, and he does do well when he even goes outside sometimes, not all the time, but when he does go outside. I know he's supposed to make a Stephen King Tales from a Buick 8 or something one thing that I've heard off and on.
I wish he would because, frankly, Creepshow, I wish they would try to do something like Creepshow again, not Creepshow 3, but something in that.
No, of course not that.
You know, where they do these short stories and... Because really, Romero and Stephen King's, you know, meeting of the minds on Creepshow was a perfect, you know, symbiotic relationship. They both fit each other. And I think more so than, you know, Darabont and Stephen King, I think Romero should try to reach out to Stephen King and they might want to work on something a little more down and dirty.
I think that's a good point. Well, let me ask you this, you guys, this before we leave the Romero films. Which do you prefer, Land or Diary?
Oh,
Jesus Christ, Jamie! Don't give me that hesitating grunt.
I'll say Land because I'm assuming because of the backing and that it took so long for Romero to get financing for it that he did populate it with known actors, both Dennis Hopper and particularly Dennis Hopper and John Leguizamo gave that film some real vitality and energy that Diary I think is lacking.
Okay, I said I like Land of the Dead, and I've, like, gotten, like just every time I bring this up since it's come out, like, my brother gave me a hard time not liking it. He's like, how could you? It's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. But I have to say, I think both of them, and I guess, you know, I am giving Romero the benefit of the doubt because he is the godfather of this whole genre. I like to hear what he has to say. And I guess with Diary of the Dead, it seems because of Blair Witch and Cloverfield, he's behind the curve. But although Diary of the Dead was filmed long before Cloverfield, it's just a matter of release dates. But I'm always going to be curious what he has to say. I mean, I see where you guys are coming from, but, you know, I'm just glad to see he's still working.
Well, I will say here's an ironic kind of comment on the release of Diary of the Dead, because also the same day coming out that just came out this week was a 40th anniversary edition of Night of the Living Dead. And so, frankly, it's actually kind of unfair, and Romero probably should have thought twice about it, because, frankly, Night of the Living Dead just stands head, shoulders, waist above Diary of the Dead. You really can see...
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into that later in one sense, you know, tonight, Aaron, because we're going to talk about then Raiders in the Crystal Skull. So, I mean, it's the same thing almost, I'm afraid.
There is a Night of the Living Dead, and, you know, if you don't own another one of the dozen or so versions of this that have been released previously, pick it up. It's pretty much got all the features that
you buy it for me?
it should be noted, let me note this on a serious note, that this is the actual Romero version of Night of the Living Dead, not that god-awful new version where one of the producers went back and shot new black and white footage to insert in it to give it a little more profundity.
That's not the Tom Savini. You're not talking about Tom Savini.
No, this is, there was one of the...
3D? This is the one in 3D, you mean?
No. There was a producer named, I think it's Russo, I forget, Frank Russo, or James, I forget the producer's name, but Russo. He back in like 98, 99, around there, he went back and shot new footage in black and white to and he basically shot new scenes, but to cut into the film.
Oh,
to
God.
Expand the film, and it was just awful. It was just awful. It was particularly, I think it was a priest in an asylum. There was like an epilogue, a coda, if you will, to comment on everything, to kind of
similar to what Carpenter did when he had to expand Halloween for television broadcast. Remember those extra scenes in the mental institution. And you just get Donald Pleasance on a scene, give him like three lines of dialogue, and it takes him forever to recite them anyway. So that's like a 10-minute scene right there, three lines of dialogue.
So it was just god awful. So luckily, this is not that version.
Okay,
so
that's
that
good.
Clean. I want to make that clear.
I know Jamie's going to buy this for me, but
it's in the mail with Captain Abu Rod, dude.
That's awesome, man. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Hey, we got our guest. We're waiting for our guest to call in. So. Let's talk about the big behemoth that comes out this Tuesday, perfect for Memorial Day.
Yes.
The Rambo Deluxe box set. I mean, the comprehensive ironclad box set.
This is 1, 2, 3, 4. What? How many discs is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It's like six, isn't it?
Six discs.
Oh wait, the six. Okay.
Yeah, this is the granddaddy of box sets in a tin can Rambo. The only thing missing, I kind of wish they'd given us like a little replica of a knife. The only thing missing.
Actually, let me go into my room and get. I have a knife, I think, actually, from these.
It is missing a weapon, isn't it?
If not the knife, at the very least, the little green medallion necklace. We could have sprung for one of those.
Right.
Or a framed photo of Richard Crenna.
Yeah.
Dog tags, yeah.
Dog tags or a headband. Anyway, so yes, this is the ultimate ultimate Rambo box set in a tin can, six discs. It has all four of the Rambo movies plus a second disc for the new Rambo film, and another disc of nothing but their own special features. And one of the reasons this is the box set to get because there have been two other previous Rambo box sets with just the first three Rambo films, which I have not picked up because I kind of knew sooner or later this Ultimate Edition would come through, and it has, and it is all you really need in Rambo. Each film comes with a commentary and deleted scenes and then their own features.
Who does the commentaries on them?
Stallone.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. Well, he does it on the first and the fourth one.
Yeah, he does.
Those are my favorites, by the way. The first.
The directors do it on the second and third. Peter McDonald and George P. Cosmatos.
He passed away.
He did.
He passed away a few years ago. And
presumably, he did it while he was still alive.
I thank you, Jamie. I realized that. I didn't need like a thank you. Jamie's like our own Fox Mulder. He's an expert on the supernatural.
Even though it's arguable whether or not he did that with Cobra's commentary.
Well, we don't. Well, see, the question is, do we know? We don't even know when he died. I mean, they say, I think the date was that's when they found him.
I think when bad movies stopped being made, that was the date.
Oh, man, you guys are cold-blooded, man.
I know
we're going to get an
terrible.
Angry letter from his estate. I mean,
that's
I just
terrible.
Know it.
That's terrible.
I mean, I love Tombstone, man.
Tombstone was very good.
Actually, Cobra is one of my all-time favorites, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. It's like a guilty pleasure of mine. But Rambo 2, remember when you were a kid and you watched Rambo 2 and you were exhilarated by it?
Rambo 2 was. I remember Rambo 2 vividly because that was Memorial Day, 1985. So I was like six, going on seven,
Going on 7, Aaron?
Yeah, I was six, going on seven.
Holy shit! I was, I think, 14 or 15. Oh my God! Okay.
And so that was the film. That's what I wanted to see. That was back when school let out on Memorial Day. So it let out. And me and my dad took me to go see Rambo,
Wait,
First Blood,
school
Part
let
2.
Out? You were done with school that year?
Yeah.
At Memorial Day? Wait, I'm sorry, Jamie. No, wait, you were, that's, man, you're lucky. We had another 3 weeks to go. All right.
And so Rambo, and remember, 1985 was probably Stallone's last peak year. Because remember, Thanksgiving of 85 was Rocky IV.
Wouldn't you say that's his best year?
I'm going to go with 82, because that's Rocky 3 and First Blood.
Okay, I just thought because that was the year, like, he was really, when those two, when Rocky IV and Rambo II came out, he was really on top of the world with the Vanity Fair cover with Bridget Nielsen. I mean, really on top of the world.
Good on top of something.
Well, yeah, I mean,
on top of Mount Rushmore with Brigitte Nielsen. Let me tell
you.
Yeah, you know, all of them have their little. All of them are essentially Rambo movies. They kind of differ in quality, I think, but all of them give you what you need, the primal kind of thing that you need from a Rambo movie. There's a really cool scene in Rambo 3 where he treats a wound with gunpowder. You guys know the scene I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
It lights a flame and it goes all the way through his midsection. You know, stuff like that. And in Rambo 2, obviously, I just bring back the feelings of, like, childhood and watching it as a kid. And he blows lots of stuff up really good. And First Blood actually feels like a rediscovery for me because it's so kind of modest, you know? And it feels a little bit more honest because of its modesty. Did you feel that way, Aaron?
I do.
Hello?
He does, and then he had to hang up.
what was that about?
That was weird. That was extremely strange. Maybe he really needed to go to the bathroom or something. But let's talk about this First Blood. How long has it been since you've seen it, Jerry?
It's been a very long time, but I have to make a confession. I always thought the first one was the best one. And for me, I thought it was really one of the best things Stallone had done outside the first couple of Rocky films.
Right.
I really just thought, because, I mean, yeah, 2 is good, but it's such a Reagan-era fairy tale when you look back at it.
Yes.
It really is. And the third one, well, current events sort of got the best of him. But I do like all the things with Richard Crenna when he's telling, you know, the guy says, who is this man, God? And he goes, hey, you better hope he has mercy on you.
the movie's chock full of that kind of delivery.
But I love the new one. I won't lie to you.
Your worst nightmare. Yeah.
Yeah. I love
Aaron,
the new one.
Aaron, that was just about the weirdest.
dude, what happened?
That's our my phone acted up on me there, so I apologize.
Okay,
that's okay. It happens to me a lot.
Yeah. So no, but well, Rambo 2 is interesting in that you know, the story is that Cameron's script was a pure action film, and then Stallone kind of brought in this political aspect to all the action stuff. What is interesting about that is that Cameron really is kind of suited to kind of that conservative action. If you look at, what is True Lies but a new type of Rambo, a similar type of Rambo story?
I mean, you have two conservative icons, Charlton Heston and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, so, but Rambo 2 does have, it's a very naive film, but it does have, like the first film, have a very simple but very heartfelt message about POWs and the treating of veterans. It's not until really Rambo 3 is really when it gets into comic. I mean, that truly is a comic book film, but unfortunately at that time we were finally, I think, starting to get burned out in that Reagan era invincible action hero.
We also had Perestroika, Glasnost, all that was coming, working in favor. You know, the end of the Cold War basically was beginning.
Yeah.
Right, and don't forget that in the summer of '88, you know, Rambo 3 once again, Memorial Day, big time release, but literally like 6 weeks later, we get Die Hard. John McClane is a new type of action hero. You know, he's a guy that we could relate to. He wasn't invulnerable. You know, invincible. This is the guy who got his feet cut with glass, and we could relate to that, and we could relate to the pain. And so it was a new changing of the guard and type of
action. You could relate to the gunpowder in the midsection?
I could. It happened to me
kidding.
A lot during that time.
I'm kidding. You know, each of them have their own kind of charms, I find. But for me, I mean, going back to watching First Blood, just very, very simple man versus small town sheriff, you know, department out in nature where he rules. It really kind of sings, you know, a lot of that film for me. And it's very telling that Stallone, I mean, he had apprehensions about doing that film because he'd never really done anything like it before.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he have apprehensions? I'm just curious.
It's kind of interesting, you know. First Blood is always held up, you know, the first Rambo film. But if you really look at it tonally, it's a very end of the 70s type of action film. It's very bleak. It's very downbeat.
It's incredibly bleak.
Even though it didn't even have the original ending, its ending is still pretty much of a downer,
mm-hmm.
and has a lot of anger that's, you know, still from the fallout of the 70s. And so it has that at the time, you know, back in 82, 81 when it was being made, that was starting to become harder and harder to find in American films. And really, you look at this whole one man takes on a town type of thing, urban warfare type of thing.
Right.
Really, First Blood is the best Chuck Norris film Chuck Norris never made.
Right.
That's right.
May I ask?
Didn't Tommy Lee Jones do something similar like The Park Is Mine or something?
Rolling Thunder.
Rolling Thunder, which is a Paul Schrader script.
That's an incredible film.
And Rambo 2, I mean, it's silly, but I think it's silly in the way that most wish fulfillment movies are. And that for me kind of falls in
May
that category.
I ask something?
Yeah, go ahead. And then our guest is on the line, so we'll bring him up in just one second.
Do you think, because I know there was, when Rambo 2 came out, there was, you know, the New York Times Magazine piece about him, and it was stated that he was in Switzerland teaching at a girls' school during the Vietnam War. Do you think that he did these films really sort of as a way to make up for that, or is that just never even played into the equation?
I don't think it played into the
equation.
Okay. I don't think so.
Okay,
that's,
I just always wanted to ask someone who knew about these things that, so.
My immediate response is, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I never heard that. But doesn't it strike you, because I think that we all agree that the last Rambo, I mean, it was kind of everything you wanted from a kick-ass Rambo movie squared. I mean, we're shocked at how far it went.
But does
it kind of remind you of the Romero thing in a way, like placing some kind of socio-political importance?
That's by accident, I think.
Well, I think the interesting question is going to be, and I have it for Matt, is that when we bring him on, why do you think people were more nostalgic for Rocky than they were for Rambo? Because Rambo obviously did not do as well as Rocky. And it seemed that people were more nostalgic for one character and not the other.
Well, do you have our guest, his intro up? You want to go ahead and bring him on?
Okay. I have it. Let us. let me get to it.
This is exciting. I've been looking forward to this, like an in-depth discussion on Rambo from someone who actually has coherent thoughts on it.
Well, here we go. For the last 15 years, he has been one of the most insightful movie critics around. Beginning at the Dallas Observer in 1991, he came into his own at the turn of the century as one of the rotating lead critics of the New York Press. There, he was the perfect counterbalance to the kamikaze writings of Armand White. At the New York Times, he brought his keen sense of observation and rigorous attention to detail to movies that were not exactly top priority in the Times Arts and Leisure section, films like James Wan's Dead Silence. In January 2006, he launched the site The House Next Door, one of the very best places to find in-depth writing on movies, trends, and all things important to the serious cinephile. And he recently turned over the editing duties of The House to Movie Geeks United contributor Keith Ulick in order to embark on a new journey as a filmmaker. Please welcome former film critic turned filmmaker Matt Zoller Sykes.
Matt, are you with us? Yeah, I'm there.
Welcome, Matt.
Holy crap, I feel like I should, I should have brought a virtual bottle of wine for everybody after that.
Or you should be on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, I know. It's like, you know, with graffiti on my nose, but yeah. So Rambo, you know, let's get into it.
Rambo,
absolutely.
Beautiful thing. We're
bring it on.
We're talking about the box set. And so, Matt, since you're probably one of the, I don't know how old Jerry is, but you were around when First Blood came out, so my first...
I was, yeah, and actually, you know, you mentioned New York Press, and I just have to bring up, just because it's apropos here, Godfrey Cheshire, who is the other member of the Triptych trilogy, whatever, he told me that his all-time favorite movie marquee was one in a small town in North Carolina. He actually snapped a picture of it, and it was from 1982, and it was two screens, and it was showing The Last American Virgin and First Blood.
Wow.
Yes. You could
that
get,
is
oh, that's there's photographic proof if you wanted.
You
took, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I did. I saw the first one on HBO. I actually missed it in the theater and really liked it a lot. And somewhere between 1982 and 85, I started to develop a sense of movie history, or at least recent movie history.
Right.
I was watching a lot of films from the 50s and 60s and 70s and kind of working my way back. And between 82 and 85, that's when Rambo went from being, as you mentioned, Aaron, kind of a sort of a weird, like, you know, put him in the telepod from The Fly type of merger of the 70s anti-hero and the 80s ass-kicking, you know,
right.
Superman. To just being a flat-out Superman and kind of a tool of the state, like in the way that Frank Miller's The Dark Knight, how he sort of reinterpreted Superman as the president, as sort of an extension of the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and you know, he's emblematic. He's, you know, and Pauline Kael in her review of Rambo 2 called him our national palooka, and that's definitely the way he set him up. But you know, to answer one of the questions that was posed earlier here, do you think that this is partly atoning for the fact that he was in Switzerland teaching girls how to play volleyball during the Vietnam War? And you know, maybe, but then again, I just think Stallone is shameless. I mean, like his entire
okay,
career.
Okay, I think that's a good, no, but thank you for
his
saying
that.
His
entire career has been shameless, and I think that, you know, if First Blood had been made in 1979, Rambo would have died at the end. And
yeah.
And if he, you know, I just think because that was more suited to the 70s era, and I think
right.
that he is a master. And when I say that he, you know, he is an opportunist, he, you know, I mean that just as a statement of fact. Like this guy can, he's got a Rambo-like ability to kind of smell the wind and know, you know, what way, you know, the future is coming from. Like he's been, you know, we make fun of him for stuff like Stop and My Mom Will Shoot, but he's been behind some pretty major zeitgeist movies in his own
right.
way. And this
major,
series was
yeah.
absolutely right up at the top along with Rocky.
Well,
and I appreciate that, Matt, for you saying that and addressing that, because I've always wanted to know what, you know, because there was always that little mini controversy when that came out, that factoid about his where he was during the war when Rambo 2 came out. So I really do appreciate you addressing that.
Here's a question that we posed it early, and that why do you think people were more nostalgic for Rocky Balboa and not Rambo? Because they Stallone obviously saw that Rocky Balboa worked, and so it would seem obvious that particularly in this our saturation in the Iraq War that maybe a Rambo film would work. But why do you think people were nostalgic for one and not for the other? Could it be that if Rambo had come out in 03, 04, it would have clicked more than coming out in
08? That's possible. But then again, one thing I will say for the Rambo films, I don't think any of them rise to the level of art except maybe possibly the first one, which
mm-hmm.
is a pretty pretty great action film and very, very serious for the type of movie that it is. But I will say that they were politically engaged and politically aware, and they did not happen to be my particular type of politics, but they
right.
at least they had that. And they had that in the way that the films that John Wayne made in the 60s were and early 70s that were expressing kind of a Nixon silent majority attitude expressed their politics. And,
right.
and you don't see that really now. It's very, very rare. In fact, it's almost unprecedented for an action hero for the action that they are responsible for to be linked to a particular view of you know how American force should be projected onto the world. And when you do get it, it's usually pretty subtle, and there's often kind of a more bitter aftertaste. But I think also, you know, just again to go back to the idea of Stallone as a product of his, you know, as a product of his times and as a guy who wanted to epitomize his times, Rambo 2 came out in 85. It was right after, it was shot sometime around the time that Reagan was running for re-election, and it was pretty much a lock. And the country was extremely conservative, and we were not involved in an actual official shooting war of any kind, although we had all sorts of covert stuff going on. So we were very safe. We were very safe. We could imagine this fantasy of this Superman with scars on his chest running around in the jungle with an M60. You know, like we could
right.
do that. And Top Gun was part of that. That came out a year later. And I just don't think it's any surprise that, with the exception of World War II, when we've been at war, the movies have tended to be a little bit darker and a little more. There's a kind of a bitter aftertaste when America or its representative projects an immense amount of force onto somebody who represents the other. And it ought to be that way. And even World War II, the chickens came home to roost with film noir.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Let me take a phone call real quick, Aaron. I'm sorry, we got a phone call up here. C-Duck, you're on the air. C-Duck, are you with us? Okay. This headset thing isn't working.
I think that headset thing's not working out.
No, it's
not working out very well.
Let me ask you this.
We tried C-Duck. I'm sorry, man.
Let me ask you this, man.
Yeah.
In that, but going back to the original question, why do you think that Rambo, this last one in Burma, didn't click the way that Rocky Balboa did?
I think he just waited too long to make it. You know, I mean, I think the gap between installments was too immense, and there wasn't that presence that there was with, say, the Indiana Jones movies.
Right.
You know, the Indiana Jones movies, for one thing, were just more, they had more universal appeal because Indy did not represent any particular political standpoint. There was nothing controversial about the character of Indiana Jones, although
not at all, right.
people had their issues with the second film, but not certainly nothing on the order of Rambo where people were arguing about it, you know?
It's not until, I've read a couple of reviews, just to digress real quick on the Indy thing, it's not until a couple of reviews on his latest film that I've read a couple of critics have said that Indy is spiritually aware and has been very respectful to the Bible, which I found kind of odd because me and Jamie were talking that up until, you know, even in Last Crusade, at best, Indiana Jones is a secularist. At worst, he's an atheist. He's always...
See, I didn't get that impression from the movie. I got the sense that he was, you know, maybe he was respectful of the idea that there's a world beyond the one that we can see, that we can sense.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely got that sense. And if you were Indiana Jones, wouldn't you be?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you've been through what he's been through and you've seen, you know, angels come out of the ark and make people's heads explode, you know, I'd get to a church, you know.
Yeah. Or the power of the grail.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. There's an 800-year-old knight waving goodbye to you. That would cure your atheism
life?
Right quick, I would think.
Yeah. And does he have eternal life because he drank from the grail?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. But if he did, it was redundant because, you know, nobody could lay a hand on him up to then. So,
right.
Well, let's try to bring Rambo into the present day. And that I remember you telling me one time that I think one of, if not the first piece of kind of film writing you wrote in college was back in 88, and so you contrasted the character of John Rambo to John McClane because Rambo 3 and Die Hard came out at the same time.
They were out during the same summer, and I was really struck by that. And 88, you know, in retrospect, it seems kind of hard to believe, but in 88, everybody was anticipating that the third Rambo film would be gigantic because the second one had been.
Right.
And Bruce Willis was a guy from Moonlighting. And when
Blind
it was and when it was reported that he'd been paid $5 million, the princely sum of $5 million, which is like, you know, nowadays that should be read aloud by Dr. Evil while he's chewing on his pinky, you know, so much more for that. But the idea of this TV actor being paid $5 million, basically because they knew that this movie was going to be a hit and they needed a leading man and they didn't particularly care who it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they got Willis, and he was hot at the time, and it made him a star. But it was striking that audiences really took to Die Hard, and also to Midnight Run, which came out that summer, and they were not
Deadpool.
I didn't get the sense that the Deadpool and Rambo 3 had nearly as much excitement around them. You know,
no,
I didn't hear
did
people
not.
Talking
they...
about those movies, and even in the summer of '88, people I knew were already quoting Midnight Run and like dragging people to see Die Hard who wouldn't be caught dead going to see an action film starring Bruce Willis. And in fact, I personally brought some friends to see that, including my friend Barry Maupin,
mm-hmm.
who later, he was a musician. He later was a music supervisor on my first feature. But Barry, I dragged him out of his room at the fraternity house and said, you have to see this movie, it's playing at the Valley View Mall. And I borrowed a car from my friend John and drove him out there, And we saw it at the last show on a Thursday night at the mall, and we were the only two people in the theater. And it was late September. I mean, it played for a long time for a movie like
that.
That's
back when movies would play for months mm-hmm. and not weeks.
Yeah. And he loved it. He absolutely loved it. And at the end, when the music segued into Ode to Joy, he turned to the projectionist and yelled, "Crank it!"
Yeah.
And the projectionist cranked it.
We were talking about this earlier. Would you say that begins the transition of Rambo 3, where it truly is an out-and-out comic book, indestructible character, where John McClane, the image that I always come back to is him picking glass out of his feet. That scene is something that everyone in the audience could relate to.
Well, but I think it's more a matter of tone, because if you recall, all of the Rambo films have had a scene where Rambo tends to his own wound with no anesthesia. And in the first one, he stitches up an arm wound. And in the second one, I can't remember what it is. I think he, I know there's got to be an instance of him doing that. In the third one, he, like, pours gunpowder into a wound and lights it and goes, "Roar!" You know.
That's my favorite, yeah.
Yeah, and, that was sort of the very erotic. That was sort of the Indiana. That was sort of the Rambo film's answer to the creepy crawly scenes in the Indiana Jones movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think you know that's where the audience goes, "Oh my God, I can't believe he did that." But so Rambo did that too, you know. But I just think it's a matter of tone, and I think when you actually look objectively at what happens in the Die Hard films, it's no more or less preposterous than what Rambo gets involved in. And in fact, when Die Hard was being shopped around, it was being sold as Rambo in an office building.
Mm. Mm.
You can see that.
It is funny up until this last Rambo, I mean this last Die Hard film, which we won't acknowledge, but the second one and the third one, as preposterous as the plots got, Airport, you know, or Island of Manhattan, that human quality of the John McClane character was there. By the time of each film, he was a bloody mess and we could still relate to him as, like, that is going to be a lot of pain the next
mm-hmm.
one. This last film...
He was, yeah.
You know, this last film, we couldn't relate to him at all, but...
Not really. I mean, I think I could sort of relate to him as a dad, but that was about it, because, you know, I couldn't see him... You know, when he was swinging from a cable and beating the crap out of a guy, it was just, you know.
Yeah.
But again, that too is a matter of tone. If Indiana Jones did that, I don't think I'd think twice about it.
Well, and here, so we'll try to wrap this up. What do you think, because I have my own theory on knowing, what do you think is the new version of Rambo? Because, and when I say Rambo, I mean in that this character who is, at least supposedly, according to Stallone, has been apolitical, but obviously there's a lot of conservative politics.
I think it's Jason Bourne, without a doubt. Jason Bourne is, you know, he is Rambo in a lot of ways. He's a killing machine created by the government who turns on its creators. You know, he's Frankenstein's monster in the same way that Rambo was. And you know, what is the story of the Bourne films but a Frankenstein's monster seeking out his father in order to get an explanation for who he is and why he is the way he is, and then he kills his daddy. And then in the second film, he finds out there's a daddy behind the daddy, and he has to kill him. And then behind every bad daddy, there's another bad daddy. That's the Bourne films. And I think they're very political in their you know, their critique of executive branch secrecy and power.
And the other character I want to throw out, it's not as, I guess you could say, in-depth as Jason Bourne, but one who in the last couple of seasons has started to kind of break down in his resolve to a certain extent is Jack Bauer.
Yeah, Jack Bauer too, and I think that Jack, well, I haven't watched it too much in recent seasons, so I can't speak authoritatively to that, but Jack always struck me as much more of a, he was more of a Rambo who never left the reservation. You know, I mean, he's part of the machine, and even when he's gone, he's not gone for long, and he's instinctively loyal to his bosses and to his country and all of that. And when he gets betrayed, then he turns on them. But it's not, you know, he tends to still, in his weird way, give people the benefit of the doubt. And
he seems to be.
But yeah, he's definitely there. But I don't think he gets. I don't know. I feel like Bourne has a more global view of his own fate and why he is who he is. I love those movies. I think they're just great.
Bourne is pretty. It seems that. Just on the Jack Bauer tip, real quick, he seems to be loyal to an ideal of America, and just kind of temporarily loyal to who's ever in kind of an authority figure, because he's never really he seems to have the belief, and it just seems to work out in his favor, that he's always going to do what is the best in the best interest of the country, and please don't get in my way.
Exactly right. Well, he's more like Dirty Harry in that way. You know, in the way that Dirty Harry was, Dirty Harry did what was necessary for society, even if society didn't want him to. You know, he was the guy who did what, he did the dirty jobs that the other people didn't have the stomach for. That was the concept, I think. And Bauer definitely walks in those shoes.
It is interesting, just on this last one, I guess, in that, that these characters who kind of pivot on kind of a conservative value, in that it's not, it seems to be they just don't, they have a real distrust in McClane and Rambo and Jack Bauer and Dirty Harry, a real disdain for anyone who has a higher rank or even a higher pay grade than they are.
Absolutely.
That's just anyone, you know, no matter how small the difference in rank or pay grade, they are not to be trusted until they've earned it, and even then they.
Well, I think that's the. I think that's a really important point, because you know, it plays into the way that movies, the way that the idea of the rebel has been depoliticized and kind of turned into a label.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like it's that sort of Ivan Reitman movie formula. Like, you know, the Bill Murray characters and Meatballs and Stripes and Ghostbusters, he's anti-authoritarian only in the sense that he's rude to people who could have him fired or sent to jail. You know, it's not like he's really a rebel against the system. He's not striking against what the system represents. The only thing he's against is people telling him what to do. That's all. And I do think there's a definite strain of that among a lot of action heroes, and I don't think Rambo really fell into that. And I have to give credit for that to Stallone and, you know, his collaborators, but mostly Stallone, because he was really driving that franchise. He did adhere to the one bad apple school of thought, though. I mean, ultimately it was usually revealed that it was not the CIA that was really at fault. It was this bad CIA guy, you know.
Let me pick up a phone call. We have a listener phone call, and then our next guest is on the line. We'll get to her in just a couple of minutes, because that's going to be a fantastic segment as well. 301, listener phone call, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Jamie.
Yes.
Hey, Jamie, this is Sean, Jerry's friend. I called a week ago during the Indiana Jones tribute show. you there, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm there.
Well, listen, I got to apologize. I remember you said 6 o'clock. Here it is, like at like 7 o'clock. I said, oh, my gosh, the show's on the air. Let me see if I can call in and see what's going on, because I had no clue what the show was about. So I'm totally unprepared.
You're online more often than you know.
That's right. Well, it was interesting. It's a real interesting conversation. I mean, this is the kind of conversation you and I have. So, anyway,
let me ask you real quick, Sean. Do you have a preference of Rambo films out of the four of them?
Yeah, I do. I've always liked the first one, but I did not disdain any of the other ones. I haven't seen the fourth one yet. I like there's two things about, like, the first one I like because for some reason Sylvester Stallone is like the only male actor that can get me to cry, because when he starts crying, it's like, what's left? But we all gotta cry if he cries.
Yeah, that's true.
But I just really like
He looks like he's being physically grabbed and wrung out.
Yeah.
He cries. Yeah.
He's always had the saddest eyes, and he's had some of the saddest eyes for.
He does.
You know.
He's got a great way of. Okay, he goes through all this radical. Monstrous behavior, but it's like we all feel justified in it, because, you know, you've got to see him get torn down and beaten to the ground before he finally lashes out. It's almost like he's been giving subliminal warnings all along, because he doesn't want to hurt anybody, but it gets to the point where they just decide not to read that.
Maybe
and here he goes.
It's the Incredible Hulk. Don't make me angry.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you,
Sean. You're welcome to stay on the line if you'd like to continue listening, my friend.
Sure.
But I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah.
All right, I will take up your time. All right, take care.
Thank you, buddy. Let me ask a question, and Aaron, I'll let you close it up so we can bring our next guest. With Rambo 4, what do you think these characters have? It sounds a little silly given the kind of film it is, but perhaps not. Given the arc of all of these characters involved, what do you think each side learns, Stallone and the volunteers? the medical volunteers, because it's implied that each of them come to a different realm of they reach a different realm of knowledge at the end of this blood-soaked journey. I mean, did you get that sense? What do you think it wants to leave you with, if anything?
Is that to Aaron or to me?
No,
that's to you. That's to you.
That's to you, man. That's to you.
Well, I felt very strongly when I saw it that this was about as strong a pro-intervention in Iraq movie that I've ever seen, and there haven't been too many of those because Hollywood, as we know, skews left. And I thought it was very strongly a pro-interventionist tract, I mean, to the point of being almost a list of talking points. I mean, the characters, when you listen to the dialogue coming out of their mouth, it's along the lines of, well, what, you know, it's a humanitarian, they're attempting a humanitarian solution to a problem that can only be solved with military force. That's the plot of the movie. And they happen to call the place Burma, but it's basically Iraq, and the lead guy has that sort of tin pot dictator vibe that Saddam Hussein had. I think it's really just a case of lights, you know, changing the name of the country and shooting it somewhere different. But I think it's really it's Iraq. It's really an Iraq war film. And Stallone is very crafty. And I think that it's not his fault that audiences failed to show up. I think he completely he created a Rambo movie that was absolutely in the spirit of the second and third ones. You know, it was wore its politics on its sleeve while maintaining plausible deniability and saying it was just a human story.
Right, now you're right. But it was great. I enjoyed it. I mean,
but yeah, and it was, you know, and I actually liked his character. I thought his character was quite interesting, and I found that the final shot of the movie where literally bringing him home quite moving. And it was like an homage to The Searchers, almost, the way they shot it. It was like The Searchers in reverse with Ethan Edwards coming back to the house. And I thought, like, the only thing that would make this perfect would be if he gets to his dad's house and the door opens and there's John Wayne.
Yeah, his father would have to be 120 years old by now, too. I find that
what was up with that? There should be a whole. There could be an entire piece written about movies that I, in a New York Press piece that I wrote about The Rock. I labeled a certain type of film emotional Viagra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're basically all these movies about, like, they're old guys, but they can still kick ass, and they're sleeping with women a third their age. Like, there's so many of those. Like, Sean Connery and you know, Anthony Hopkins cornered the market on them for a while, and now it's, you know, Stallone and Harrison Ford and all these guys, John, you know, Bruce Willis, they're all coming back and doing it. Women don't really get allowed to do that, but, you know, that's a whole other issue.
Aaron, I'll let you ask one more, and then we're going to close up.
Well, I think we've covered pretty much everything on the Rambo films. I just think that it's just that, you know, Stallone said that he'd always mess with the character. But what do you think that he's moving on to his next project? He wants to do a remake of Death Wish. I have no idea what stage this project is in. To me that almost seems kind of inevitable that Stallone would want to.
Well, yeah, it sort of is, and he kind of already did that. With Cobra,
right?
You know, which was very much kind of a, you know, sort of like Death Wish after a couple of lines of coke. You know, I mean, that sort of a vibe to it. You know, but I don't know. I mean, I just think I'm tempted to say that he's miscalculating, but then again, you never know with Stallone. He keeps surprising you.
Get Carter, and he couldn't do that right.
He couldn't do that right, and that was because he wanted to be liked. And I think that's ultimately Stallone's fatal flaw more often than not, is he plays these characters who are sort of beyond the question of likability.
True.
Like, that's not really why you would watch them, and I think that's what made the first Rambo film so memorable and so durable, is the fact that the movie itself presented a guy in a situation where you have to sympathize with him, but it wasn't out there holding your hand and telling you how sweet he was. He was like a beast. He was like a hunted animal, and I think that worked.
That's a good point. That's a great point.
I'll just close out. I just think, you know, it was funny when Roy Scheider passed that I remember a lot of bloggers and a lot of people said, well, you know, I kind of wish Tarantino had given him one of those last roles, and I kind of do wish that Tarantino, if anyone, I mean, this is truly out there wish fulfillment, is that if ever someone could truly use Stallone in a good way, I would think Tarantino would be the best person to kind of show people what Stallone could do as an actor, because he is more than Schwarzenegger. I mean, Schwarzenegger gets, I guess, the better reviews, but Stallone has always been the better actor and the better writer, if you will. It's just that he doesn't seem
to... Yeah, I agree, although he's just got enough sort of, I don't know, he tends to sabotage himself in a couple of different ways. But I think Stallone, in some ways, does have the temperament of an artist, and that's what makes him intriguing, even when his movies are terrible.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much, buddy, for joining us tonight.
Matt, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
All righty. Take care, guys.
Thank you, Matt. That's Matt Zoller Seitz. That's a great treat to have him on the show finally.
Oh,
that's,
absolutely.
And an interesting conversation, a much longer conversation about Rambo than I thought I would be able to carry on. But that's
that is a brilliant line, that Cobra is death wish after a couple of lines of Coke.
I like Cobra's one of my guilty pleasures, so please excuse me.
I love Cobra too, man.
Okay. Our next guest is on the line and ready to go, and she has a fantastic new book. I can't wait to discuss this with her. Why are we as an audience so drawn to the concept of evil? I mean, sure, the hero might save the day, but in some of our greatest films, it's the villain who provokes the most discussion. We are honored tonight to welcome to the program a very accomplished speaker, consultant, writer, award-winning producer, director, whose new book titled The Power of the Dark Side explores methods for creating memorable villains in dangerous situations. She teaches at the very best schools and companies across the globe, and she's also the founder of MythWorks, which you can find at www.mythworks.net. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the program Pamela J. Smith to discuss her new book with us. Let me bring her up real quick on our switchboard. Let me bring the switchboard up here. Ms. Smith, are you with us?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight. I loved your book. I can't wait to discuss it with you. Give me a little sense first, though, of your career trajectory, how this journey began for you.
Well, I've always been interested in writing, and like a lot of people who are writers, started telling stories and writing when I was very young. And just kind of naturally fell into it after a couple of false starts at pre-med and music and other things like that, and got into film school at the University of Texas at Austin. And it was a great place to be going to film school, learning about film. A lot of Hollywood movies were coming there, and I worked on a couple of them and then moved to Hollywood to pursue a real career in show business.
So tell me what film school did for you. What was the curriculum and what about it drew you further into the film industry?
A couple of things, actually. One of them was the excitement and the fulfillment of collaboration.
Yeah.
You know, as a writer, you know, you're just stuck in front of a keyboard and you've got a world going on in your mind, but it can also be kind of a lonely and isolated place. When you actually get on a film set and start working with other people and sharing those visions and hopefully everybody tapping into the same vision, if you've got a good, you know, director and a good sense of that unity, it's really magic.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it was really good for me because I have a dual career as a producer and director and as a writer. To learn a lot of different aspects of the production process. So I think my first job was as script supervisor, the second one was as the chef, and then, you know, being a grip, and then doing wardrobe, and then, you know. So film school gave me all those different opportunities to see a kind of a holographic view of the filmmaking process, which then, when I got into more serious writing, it really gave me a heads up on what can and can't be done on a set.
Right, right. But your experience as as a producer and a director in particular, has that made you a better writer?
Absolutely, absolutely. for one thing, pardon me, you know that it's probably not a really good idea to write in those elephants in pink tutus on the budget, right? It's going to be hard to get. And real
right.
expensive. So you learn a lot of the practicalities. And then also you learn a lot about coverage and what needs to be in every scene.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, if the writer is aware of that, it makes it a whole lot easier for whoever's directing it, whether or not they have any experience directing. If the script itself is written with those kinds of indications. Now, obviously, you know, you're not going to write close-up and then wide shot and all that for a script that you're writing to sell.
Right.
But if you do write your descriptions lucidly enough, then you're really going to give the people who are actually putting it on digits or putting it on celluloid a better chance of getting the kind of coverage that they can then use to make a really full and rich story when they get into the editing room.
Yeah. With your first book was titled Inner Voices.
Actually, Inner Drives.
Inner Drives, okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, tell me a little bit about that one. What inspired that one, and what were you exploring in that book?
Oh, thank you for asking. Inner Drives, the subtitle of it is How to Write and Create Characters Using the 8 Classic Centers of Motivation, and that's the chakras. And I had been studying a lot of the mystery school and physics of metaphysics, comparative mythology, and I kept noticing that the chakras would turn up in a lot of the symbolism of the wonderful classic myths and stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, gosh, this appears to be just a natural storytelling tool. And I started looking further into it and discovered that a lot of the myth makers had been people who actually studied in what they call the mystery schools. And basically, it's the physics of metaphysics and how the world works and human psychology and all that. And saw that they would make up stories to explain the different psychological states of being and how we moved through them in the course of our personal evolution or just in our everyday lives. So I just thought, well, gosh, I'll just pull all this ancient wisdom into a book and hopefully make it more accessible to writers and storytellers by giving examples from real life and from stories throughout time, and then with suggestions and exercises and how to use those chakras to create characters. And I'm now teaching actors also through this system.
Mm.
And that's been really exciting.
I definitely want to ask you about your storytelling techniques from an actor's point of view a little bit later, but this new book is called The Power of the Dark Side, Creating Great Villains in Dangerous Situations. And, you know, there's so many storytelling, screenwriting kind of how-tos out there, and this one is unique because it does deal with the concept of evil and how we represent evil in our works. Is that what first sparked the notion for this book to kind of fill that void?
Absolutely, you are so right, it was. As a story consultant, one of the biggest problems that I see is an imbalance between the protagonist and the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And you particularly find this in the genres of what we now call spiritual cinema, or in religious films, or, you know, the sweet little stories, you know, children's films. And I started looking around and didn't find anything that was really addressing that, and said, gosh, well, maybe I'll just write it. And fortunately, my publishers were amenable. And so my goal then was to put together information and insights and hopefully some inspiring clues and writing exercises that would help people create better stories because they're creating more vivid villains and because they have more believable situations for their heroes and heroines to go up against.
Yeah, tell me how it seems to me that the concept of evil, just like the kind of the concept of the hero, has morphed over the years. I mean, we're definitely not in the era with the mustache twirling villain any longer. Tell me that transformation. How has the ideal of the villain changed?
Oh, that's an interesting question, and I try to address it in the first section of the book, which is about defining evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is evil? Well, it depends on who you ask. It depends on when you ask the question. And it depends on your perspective. I think a lot of it you can You know, let's just talk about globalization for a moment. When you had people living in a small community, in a village, evil was different in scope and in impact than a global community like we have now. And a lot of that is just you define evil by what opposes what you consider a pleasant and a productive life.
Mm-hmm.
So if your life doesn't go any further than the boundaries of your farm or the edge of your village, then that which is evil is interpreted by you in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
As society has grown and as life has gotten more complex, so too have the evils that we face. The dark side has gotten bigger as well.
Yeah, this is something, and this is something that interested me, and it goes back to, I think, the way actors approach characters as well. You mentioned perspective, and you do make it clear from the beginning that evil is all a matter of perspective. I know that whenever actors are asked about, you know, how did you play that evil guy, they always say the same thing. They say, well, he doesn't think he's evil. I mean, he's perfectly, perfect reason why he's behaving the way he is. That's important, isn't it, to understand that?
Very important, and I spend quite a bit of time in the first of the book going over that and stressing to writers that you really need to understand the world view of your villain.
Yeah.
What do they believe? What rewards are they after? What justifies for them what they're doing? Although, too, you know, and this it does get a little bit dicey because you do then have a couple of types of characters where that may not really count. You know, if somebody's totally psychopathic, they just don't have the wiring in the brain
mm-hmm.
to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter if it's, they don't have to justify it, in other words. It's just what they want to do, so they do it.
Well, tell me how you fall on some of the most infamous kind of villains that we've seen in film lately. I know you speak of them in your book. How would you describe the villain, so to speak, in Seven? Obviously psychotic, but obviously has the justification for what he does in his own mind.
Yes, he does. And now here, this is me, you know, practicing psychology without a license. But
go right ahead.
I think, you know, a lot of people get an impression of good and evil when they're very, very young. Because that's
mm-hmm.
the socialization process. We all go through it. Or we'd all just be, you know, running through the streets and the jungles and then be totally wild people.
Yeah, our parents give us that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then depending on, you know, their points of view, the religion that you're brought up in,
mm-hmm.
the culture you're brought up in. For that particular character, he was obviously influenced by a very strong biblical hand. And so those seven deadly sins were, one can surmise, pounded into this character, and then because he had bad head wiring and never got wired for empathy and was a psychopath, then that impression of those evils just flipped way over into the dark side, and you put those two things together, and it became a deadly combination.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine probably the most kind of beloved, for lack of a better word, villain of the past several years is probably Hannibal Lecter. I mean, the most kind of electrifying. And I'm interested, too, in the way his character kind of parallels with the hero of the story, with Clarice, where it's tell me about that relationship, the way you see it, the strength of the hero in contrast to the so-called villain in that piece.
You know, that's a hard one because he is such a complex character, and I don't think she's that complex, but he is. Now, she is steadfast and she is honorable,
yeah.
but not terribly complex, and that's okay for that story because she serves as a mirror for his complexity.
Right.
I heard just a couple of days ago, and I wish I'd had this conversation before I wrote the book, somebody said, I think Hannibal Lecter consumed people because he loved them so much. He had this devouring curiosity and sensuality about humanity, and he just wanted to absorb it. And I kind of stood there for a moment with my mouth open and my eyes wide, and then I thought, I kind of see your point.
Especially on the prequel that they made a couple of years ago, that kind of makes sense.
It does,
yeah.
Doesn't it? And you have to step over a little bit into the side of, you know, kind of uber sensuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that consuming thing. You know how lovers often say, I just want to consume you. Don't take it seriously.
But but then, it really, it does fascinate me, Lecter's relationship with the heroine, in that he is constantly challenging her. It's not about the chase, so to speak, the good guy going after the bad guy. He is challenging a lot of what makes up her character.
Yes, and I think we might presume, without jumping into the original author's head, but we might presume that he's looking for a worthy opponent.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that smart, that clever, is always trying to find their match.
Well, that goes back kind of to the old Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi movie, The Black Cat, which was probably which was the heat of its day when you had those two titans on the same screen. And the, you know, let's be honest, at that time, I think this is the 30s, I may be wrong, but that was the be-all, end-all, the ultimate, you know, pairing up of these
yeah.
two icons.
Oh, that was
yeah.
like the Predator versus Alien of the time?
Yeah, that or whichever example you want to use.
Uh-huh.
I do think it's valuable, though, for that relationship to kind of exist. You're talking about creating dangerous situations too, to kind of make that relationship between the villain and the hero more complex, to kind of challenge the hero. And another film that you discussed somewhat in the book is Schindler's List. And would this fall into the group think kind of mentality that you cover in your book? Tell me about that notion, the group think mentality.
Oh, I love this concept because we can see it every day all around us. You know, whether or not you've come up against the bureaucracy at the DMV or you're going on a war march, a war protest march, or, you know, maybe in your story you're dealing with, you know, Darth Vader and the evil empire. There is a lockstep process. There's a hive mentality. There's a mob mood that is part of the human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And at times we just tend to lock up and march in lockstep and get locked into ideas and conform to these ideas that otherwise on our own we might not even go along with. And
right.
So when you look around and you see that, once again, in our rise from a village to a global village, and the complexity. They say that the sure sign of a culture having gone from primitive to more civilized is the rise of the bureaucrats.
Mm.
So whenever you get this, the bureaucracy, where this is the way we've always done it, this is the rule set, these are the patterns we have to follow, then you start having the problem of groupthink, where the individuals don't think for themselves. It provides a wonderful opposition for a heroine,
mm-hmm.
because you it's hard to argue with anybody. You can't find an individual to argue with.
So would that be like when you talk about globalization, I guess in the last decade or really the last two decades, and you see like films like The Constant Gardener, where the pharmaceutical company, they're the baddies. So these movies where big business has really, I guess since the end of the Cold War, big business has become the bad guy.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. The corporatization of the planet, and whether it's the corporations themselves, business, and, you know, include in there the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Yeah, they're always stand-ins.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, and I talk about it a little bit there. That through, I think it was even a clerical error back in the late 1800s, corporations in law were given the status of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave them all sorts of rights that we probably shouldn't have given them.
No, not at all.
We're reaping the bad rewards from that now.
We still are. Still.
Yes, yes. And it's the kind of thing where, you know that phrase, it takes on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just happens. you know, an idea, an ideal, an entity like that takes on a life of its own and sucks up the people who, hello, Enron,
mm-hmm.
you know, the people who work with it.
Yeah, that's like with the remake of the Fun with Dick and Jane. Big business at the time. It was like took place in 2000, but the corporation was the bad guy. Or in mm-hmm. the original Rollerball with James Caan, the corporation
yeah.
is the bad guy.
That's right, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and too bad about the remake, but...
Yeah,
you know.
I didn't even bother with it.
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine who actually got me into film school in the first place said, you know, Pamela, when Rollerball first came out, it was futuristic. Now it's a documentary.
Mm.
Because indeed the corporations have
yeah.
taken over. So yeah, groupthink is a wonderful opposition situation, a wonderful antagonist for an individual hero, because you can get that David and Goliath thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You also then have the wonderful opportunity of pulling somebody out of the system, seducing them out of it, and getting them to help.
Mm-hmm.
The turncoat, like in The Insider.
Yes.
When,
oh, you picked Jamie's favorite movie.
Oh, did I? Okay.
Anything with Pacino, you're on my side. So.
Okay, great.
I'm interested.
That whole seduction was a wonderful tour de force for him.
It really was. Yeah, absolutely. I want to close off with a little discussion on the anti-hero.
Okay.
Which seems to be becoming more and more popular as of late. You know, it used to be we liked our heroes kind of straightforward, and we see that, you know, even this weekend with the Indiana Jones film. You know, we like them
uh-huh.
vulnerable here and there, but more and more they're becoming, I see it mostly in comic book films. They have their own demons that they contend with, and it's almost like at times they are their worst enemy. What do you attribute to that kind of shift?
Okay, a couple of things, actually. In the book, I talk about the three levels of the dark side,
mm-hmm.
and one level is the dweller on the threshold, and that's our internal, personal demons that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And in a culture where self-actualization and self-investigation and self-confession is really predominant, then it just kind of makes sense that our media heroes are going to be of the same ilk.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get a lot of this internal personal angst and investigation that's very, very different from what came out of, let's say, post-World War II.
Sure.
With the strong silent type, we just don't talk about what we saw.
Right.
We don't talk about what we felt. So there's been a shift then. The therapeutic human potential movement, I think, is responsible for a lot of that shift in how we're portraying the heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I was listening to the last part of your, the last interview.
Yes, ma'am.
And I love being able to do this. Let me just quote myself and read a little bit here from the section on the anti-hero.
Right.
Anti-heroes typically arise from overregulated, corrupt, declining societies. They uphold the true ideal, which the rest of society now just mocks or ignores.
Mm.
So, because they harken back to the good old days, rough and ready anti-heroes are more popular in a culture's stories when people are disillusioned in the overregulation stage and beyond. So I think part of it is, in a way, maybe an adjustment of what do we really want as individuals and what do we really need as a society.
Yeah.
And I think we're still trying to figure it out, which is why
yeah, yeah.
some
mm-hmm,
of the superhero
right.
stories work and others don't.
Mm-hmm.
Does that begin to answer that question for you?
I think it does. And you know, this has been a fascinating conversation.
We
could
talk to you for hours about this.
Okay.
But we can't, unfortunately, because of time constraints.
Yeah, but it's indicative of the fascinating book that you've written. And you can't help but have these kind of conversations after you've read this book. It's called The Power of the Dark Side. Pamela J. Smith, it's available now in bookstores. Pamela, please come back to us anytime in the future that you'd like. Whether you have a new book out or not, just we'd love to hear from you again.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation, and
likewise.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you
night.
So much, Pamela.
Thanks.
Bye
bye
now. That's Pamela J. Smith, author of The Power of the Dark Side. Okay, Chris has been waiting on the phone.
Let's
Aaron,
do it.
Aaron, are you still awake?
I'm still with y'all. No, it's a great, great conversation. It's amazing how many people are from Texas.
I was waiting for you to say something when she said Texas. I was waiting for some sort of recognition.
It's a huge state, dude. Chris, how you doing, buddy?
Good. How about you, man?
Good, man. I'm sorry to keep you waiting, man. We're running a little bit over tonight. I'm going to keep you waiting for a second longer because we have a listener, I think, that's on the phone here calling in. 720, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, buddy.
I had a quick question, and I don't know if she, Pamela talks about it in her book or not, but I actually teach a film class to a film as literature class to high school students.
Right.
And we were doing a little discussion on the genre of horror, and the one thing... It's perfect this came up, but the one thing we discussed is in all the movies, the villain always has just the most outlandish, most gruesome death possible. They never just shoot the villain and bam, he's dead. And I just wanted to get, maybe your opinion, her opinion on why you think that is, why these villains always, they're either impaled on a thing of spikes and then ground up or dropped off a building. It's always this grandiose death. I'd just get your thoughts on that.
I think we hunger for it's the whole morality of the thing. I think we hunger for the ultimate comeuppance with our really bad villains. I think that's the thirst. It's not good enough for them to just be shot and fall down dead, and certainly not good enough for them to get away. Even though I enjoy movies that challenge us like that, though, where he doesn't necessarily get his comeuppance, because that's not absolutely what happens in real life. Maybe that's why it's portrayed as elaborate as it is, their death, because we're tired of justice not being served in real life.
End of the first Raiders of the Lost Ark. It couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of people. What happens to them? I mean, let's be very honest. Even though it's 1936 and no one knows yet what they're going to do, we were watching it in 1981, couldn't happen to a nicer bunch. You couldn't get more gruesome than that,
Right,
the
right,
biblical
right.
powers, the wrath of God.
But
yeah.
I appreciate your call, 720. That's a very good question. I'm sorry I didn't get to it when we were during that segment, but thank you so much for calling in. I hope we shed some light on your question. Now, we're on to Indiana Jones now, guys.
That was a good segue. You got to admit, that was good.
We've been talking about it ad nauseum, and now we've all finally been able to see it. And in order of picking names out of a hat, Jerry, I want your opinion on this.
Chris was going to go first.
No, I'm going to go with you first.
Okay. I'm watching it midnight, Wednesday night. There's no magic. There's just never a wow moment in it. I think it's okay, but compared to the first three, there's no magic. There's really no emotional investment almost, I'm afraid. Do I like it? Yeah. Do I love it? No. But there's no magic in it. That's what I'm going to say, right? There's nothing in – let me put it to you like this. In the first three films, there's at least one moment, especially the first one, where you're like, wow, that's incredible. There's nothing stood out for me this time.
There's moments that you really feel like you escape.
Yeah, exactly.
In the previous ones, yeah. So you were lukewarm at best on it?
Lukewarm at best, but I'm willing to check it out again at some point in the next couple weeks.
This is a question I have, and I'll ask questions of you guys as you guys give your critiques, and we're just going to go one by one here. Do you think it benefits someone to not necessarily have been acclimated to the Indiana Jones series? Do you think they're likely to like it more?
I would recommend not seeing any of them before watching this, in one sense. The biggest mistake I think I did was the Sci-Fi Channel had the three of them on last weekend. I've made like tons of dumb mistakes on this show, as everyone knows, and it's been recorded for all time, but was one of the worst. That was one of the worst that I've done, to watch all three of them before watching this.
Yeah.
Because you're just comparing it. You can't compare any, at least the film that I saw Wednesday night, doesn't hold a candle to those.
Yeah. Aaron, what were your feelings upon watching it?
Well, I know I'm going to get labeled as the contrarian of the bunch.
No, you're not. I don't hate the film, Aaron.
Okay,
I don't.
No, but... But I'm going to say that I'm probably the one who likes it the most. I'm going to guess. I don't know what Chris thought. But I'm going to guess I'm the one who likes it the most because I agree that it is not in the league of the first, definitely the first two. And I am a big fan of the third one, and it's not in the league of those films. But I do think, and I've always had this stubborn thing that, you know, I do think it should be viewed, it should be judged, one, as part of the series, and then also viewed on its own. And I think as part of the series, it's obviously the least of the four. But I think that can be a little misleading. That doesn't mean I think it's a weak film. I actually think it's a very good film. And on its own, if you just judging it on its own film, I think it's a borderline terrific film because compared to stuff that has ripped it off, that has been ripping off Indiana Jones for the last 20 years, and I'm talking about the Mummy films and National Treasure and all
right,
that
right.
stuff.
Oh,
it's better than those, Aaron. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
And I want to posit that I'm going to say I'm definitely going to see it again probably later this week, but I'm going to say it probably has, as far as image, you know, shot to shot, image for image, it probably has some of Spielberg's best imagery in all four of the Indiana Jones films.
I'm curious.
What do you think?
I particularly like the first, I guess you could say, 15 minutes, that whole nuclear test sequence, because
right.
there's some really powerful imagery going on there. Obviously, the whole thing of this, the destruction, quote unquote, the destruction of the nuclear family, when Harrison Ford stumbles across the home and it's realized
right.
it's just dummies and it's fake, and so you're really seeing. So Spielberg is really playing with the image of the nuclear family and how it really doesn't exist and how it's really going to be destroyed with the
destruction
cloud. And then there's a great image of Harrison Ford's silhouette. Contrasted against the big mushroom cloud, and he's dwarfed by it.
Like these two iconic kind of images in the same frame, yeah.
You know, and like I said, and there's just tons of that stuff. It's a you really almost have to watch the film as imagery in motion and try to and because the story is probably the weakest of all four,
mm-hmm.
And it's most threadbare. But all the stories have been pretty weak, but image for image, there's just pretty. All the images seem to be working on at least three levels. One is just the actual image and how great it is. Two, there's usually a movie reference in every image. And then three, what is Spielberg implicating with those images? The whole thing about the nuclear family not existing and
well, that's classic Spielberg.
Yeah, that's classic Spielberg.
It's like
the way,
right back to E.T. and Poltergeist.
Right.
I mean.
But the way it's set in a 1950s setting where, you know, supposedly that was when the family was at its tightest, you know, the family unit was at its most rock steady. But here Spielberg is obliterating that. Because obviously in the 80s with Poltergeist and E.T., we're getting into the 80s, and so we're getting into divorce rates and all that kind of stuff. But no, he's putting it in the 50s. And
mm-hmm.
I actually love the 50s, you know, kind of inside jokes between American Graffiti and pop iconography.
Well, yeah.
I'm actually a big fan of 1941, so I like that kind of Mad Magazine approach
mm-hmm.
to it. I will concede the story, the actual motivation for what they're searching for is pretty thin, even by Indiana Jones standards.
It is. It's not like one sentence thing.
It's even more thin than Temple of Doom's Shankara Stones, which was
pretty
laughable. And,
I don't know about that, but let's hear other.
But,
I mean, this is. I agree with Aaron. Like, if I never saw the other films, I would have thought
Chris,
this was an incredible film.
Chris, do you want to give your uninterrupted take, or do you want me to go? Which one?
Let's go with Chris.
Let me say one thing real quick.
Inconceivable.
I don't even know if Aaron and I saw the same fucking movie this week. I feel like Aaron is taking turds and is trying to make lemonade out of it. I don't understand how you can have any base for anything that you're saying right now. I really think a lot of people are caught up in the hype of this movie. And I've really been blown away by some of the reviews that I've read after having seen it. This is the worst movie that Steven Spielberg's ever made. Forget about Indiana Jones. This isn't a weak Indiana Jones movie. It's just a bad movie.
You're saying this is worse than Always? You would rather watch Always and
Hook? I would take Always any day over this movie because at least it's a movie that has adults and it's about adults and it's an adult story. It's for adults. I'm an adult. I don't go see Surf's Up. I don't go see Monsters, Inc. because I'm an adult. I go and see movies with adults.
What about Chasing Lane Saves the World?
No. I don't go see Alvin and the Chipmunks because I don't want to see a movie for children. And this,
so did this movie strike you as kiddish on the same wavelength as like a Phantom Menace? Kiddish?
You asked Jerry like, oh, would it help not to watch the first three movies before you saw this? I think it would help to be mentally retarded if you're going to see this movie.
Jesus.
Dude, there were a couple. Never mind.
There were no redeeming moments, and I say that I'm being dead serious. I'm really not trying to be mean to this movie intentionally. I have no reason to dislike a new Indiana Jones movie just for the hell of it. I love the Indiana Jones movies, and I've watched them many times.
So you felt you got nothing from it?
I got literally nothing from this movie. I got literally nothing. There was no moment. You said there's no wow moment. There was not even approaching a wow moment. There was no moment.
No, there wasn't. That's what disturbed me. There is no wow moment in the whole film.
Okay, Chris. Okay, I understand you didn't like the film. I think we got there. But okay, then counter argue my example. The nuclear
counter argue the imagery. Is that what you're saying?
That the sequence, the nuclear test sequence. That is to me a terrific sequence. How did that thud for you? If you can explain it, how is that thudding for you?
Nuclear
test sequence. Why was that not working?
All right, let's forget the whole sequence because the sequence, first of all, it follows the opening of the movie, which is really anticlimactic and just doesn't really work. If you've gone away for 20 years and you come back and you have this opening scene with the Russians, they pull him out of the car and he goes into this warehouse and does something that anyone could have done. You know, this thing's magnetic, so he throws this stuff around. So it follows a lackluster sequence, first of all. Now, granted, when it got to the nuclear sequence and he gets in the household and, you know, dummies that he's talking to, I started to feel like maybe it was going somewhere. But then, come on, Aaron, he gets into a lead-lined refrigerator. And I'm sorry, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but if you haven't seen it, then you probably shouldn't be listening to this conversation. He gets into a lead-lined refrigerator, which is blown easily a mile. Can we agree on that? The thing is blown a mile. He rides inside of this thing and just pops out and takes a look at the mushroom cloud. This guy's like 63 years old. No one can survive.
I kept thinking of True Lies.
No one can survive. That's the thing, Jerry. There is nothing. There are several moments in this movie that are more ridiculous than True Lies. All of the other Indiana Jones movies, and everyone keeps saying this to me this week. Oh, they always had ridiculous stuff in them.
No, they didn't. Not like this.
Not like this. They had things where he would get shot in the arm, and then he would crawl under a truck by hanging by his whip. Things that are conceivable but ridiculous. And then there was always one supernatural element at the end of all three of the movies, whether it's ripping out a heart while someone's still alive, you know, voodoo, or if it's, you know, faces melting off because ghosts are flying around, or whatever it is. It always stood on the shoulders of a fucking solid, intelligent movie that you had just seen.
You
cartoony, parody nonsense from the beginning. It's Alvin and the Chipmunks with a whip.
Holy shit, you just compared it to Alvin.
And there are actually chipmunks in there.
Can I just say something? I think it's what a lot of us, I mean, maybe me, Chris, and I think you too, to an extent, Jamie, is we expect more, not more, a lot more from Spielberg. We don't expect him to do George Lucas's bidding on the set. He would be the one person we talk about.
Now you're going into my review of it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, the point that I want to make about it, the main point, I think I'm on the level of you and Aaron, where I didn't hate it. I mean, I was woefully disappointed by it. But
But
I think I'm looking at it. I'm thinking there are like little pearls where I think that this thing could have gone off and it could have really clicked, and everything bad with it from a story standpoint, I feel pretty confident blaming George Lucas, because it was George Lucas's whole idea of the MacGuffin. The MacGuffin, whether you understand him or not, you didn't necessarily have to understand him in the first three. You knew that Shankara stones, you know, you need to get that back to save the village, save the children. That's all you really need to give a whoop about that. You needed 10 minutes of discussion in the film about it. The MacGuffin in this lumbers the entire film. I mean, I actually felt sleepy in the whole midsection of this film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, am I watching an Indiana Jones movie because of this damn MacGuffin subplot?
Where's Fox Mulder?
And for him to pushed this so hard, I really, really disappointed me that Spielberg caved in like that. Spielberg himself, I think his instincts, I could see a little bit of them at the beginning. Indiana Jones is a lonely character, you know, he's gone through all these adventures, but he's alone in his life.
Yes,
so reintroducing the love of his life, I'm going to give you a chance to respond here, and then introducing that he has a son, I think that could have been mined so much more to make you actually care about what was happening in the movie, and put them in danger at the end of it. I mean, big time danger, so there's something at stake. There's nothing, the ending of this movie is dead. I mean, is it alive to anyone? Does it make any sense?
There is no villain in this movie. I love Cate Blanchett. She does not have a role to play in this movie, and she
right.
does not build up even a tenth of the terror of any of the other villains from the other three movies. It's not even close.
Well, I think that,
yeah.
I'm going to get attacked. I think that's also by design, and that the other three films were dealing in a very, when they were set in the 30s, they were dealing in a very innocent, black and white, good and bad times, where I think setting it in the 50s, we're finally getting to a point where the villain, they might not be the villain, they might actually have some humanity to them. So I think that was the motivation for that. But what what I really want to get into real quick is that, You talk about Spielberg, you know, doing this. I think the thing, you know, Spielberg has said that he can't go back to being innocent again. He said this, and that even his popcorn films of recent years, you know, Minority Report and War of the Worlds, and even The Lost World, they've all had a darkness. Basically, after Schindler's List, they've all had a very dark undercurrent through them that it seemed like Spielberg. I think he enjoyed making this film, but it seemed like it is true that he really couldn't go back to this type of innocent filmmaking.
Well, I don't mind that. You're talking to a guy, my favorite is the darkest of the whole series, which is Temple of Doom.
Right.
Yeah.
But even
yeah.
that had a – it was a dark one, but even you could tell that was still Spielberg at his kind of innocent kind of just having fun where
yeah.
like after,
yeah, but you see, Aaron – You see, Aaron, the notion is there, though. It's not
yeah.
developed. The notion that I think the key line in the movie should have been Jim Broadbent's line, we're at an age where more is taken away than given to us. You know,
right. yeah.
that notion is there. It's just not developed. That
none of it
really
is
made
developed.
That would have made this movie sing.
Excuse me, Aaron,
yeah.
do you think this is a dark film?
No, what I think, because I think it's more in the tradition of Last Crusade.
Catch Me If You Can is a darker film than this.
Yeah.
That's lighthearted.
And I think that's, and Spielberg has, I think Spielberg feels that in his mind, the best of the Indiana Jones films, which is Last Crusade is his favorite, and then Raiders, I think he feels that lightness, brightness of tone is when it's at its best, when actually now is when he really should have gone dark with the series. I will say this, here's a story point that I really didn't like. I think the real danger and energy would have come early on if the Shia LaBeouf character, who I actually think is a very good performance, had told Indy from the jump start who his mother was. And that would have really
yeah.
kicked in
yeah.
the energy.
Yeah, because it's the world's worst secret in modern cinema that he,
yeah.
you know, who he is.
And so I think he should have said, you know, hey, my mother is Marion Ravenwood. You knew her. And you do that from the beginning. That gives the film even...
It raises the stakes.
It raises the stakes, and it could be the same film, but it has more energy just inherently. But
yeah, and I think Jamie's right. The stakes are never raised.
Well, here's a question. This popped in my head last night, and
Hang on, just a second, Aaron. Let me address something you just said, because it doesn't sound like you're sure whether or not the movie is a light film or a dark film. Because you say Steven Spielberg can't go back to being innocent, and then you say, oh well, he probably should have gone darker with this one. And the thing is, I'm not trying to prove you wrong. I think you're right. I think it does have moments of light and dark in it. It doesn't choose whether it's going to be a dark film like Temple of Doom or it's going to be a light-hearted film like Last Crusade. That's the problem with it. So it comes out all muddled, and it feels like after Ghostbusters in the 80s, there was a TV show version of the Ghostbusters. It was animated. And it was the Ghostbusters, but it just didn't feel like the Ghostbusters because it didn't have
right.
an element. This feels like a TV show version of Indiana Jones meant to be shown on, he's back after 20 years and on NBC, you know, like
this
that's
is
what,
actually,
it's not even that good.
The tone of this film is actually more in line with the TV show. That is the one thing I will say. It is more in line with the young Indiana Jones Chronicles. But I have a question, and this is just in general. And I came up with this theory a couple of nights ago, and I think it holds up, and that I feel that sequels, good sequels, I'm just talking, when they make a sequel, you have a better chance of making a good sequel, as good as the original, or just a good one, the shorter the separating time. Meaning, you know, Lethal Weapon 1 and 2, there's only 2 years apart. Die Hard 1 and 2.
Well, you're still in that zone. Yeah, you're still in that
zone. Mad Max, Road Warrior, Godfather 2, I mean.
You know, Raiders and Temple of Doom, that's 3 years. And so then Last Crusade is 5 years after Temple of Doom. And so you have people
Empire
kind
Strikes
of,
Back.
And so you had people
at the
kind
same,
of...
At the same time, this is what's stunning to me, Aaron. And that's why I was willing to accept going in that this would be a lesser of all the Indiana Jones films. Because can you really recapture that magic? Hundreds of creative people together after 20 years of work, especially of work like Spielberg's done, where he's gone to these different areas in his creativity. I was willing to accept that. I was amazed at how little Spielberg's imagination was at work here, and how 15 like some of the top screenwriters in the business had their fingerprints on this, and there were some things that just felt like I didn't like the references necessarily, and I thought the 50s people in the car chase at the beginning, like, what was that there for? And then you're introducing that Kate Blanchett reads minds, and yet she's not able to do it once in the film.
She couldn't read David Cope's mind, that's for sure.
All these little plot points, like, did we not comb this over?
Yeah.
I mean, think beyond the big ideas about raising the stakes and stuff. Just the little stuff didn't add up. And I am fascinated by Frank Darabont's idea that Jerry reminded me of the other day. I'd be dying to read that script because he introduced the whole notion of an evil brother, you said, Jerry?
Yeah, there's an evil brother that Kevin Costner was going to play at one point.
Keep it in the family. I think the family idea would have worked stupendously, and I would have ignited Spielberg's imagination more so than what Lucas gave him. That's my opinion.
Here's the other fascinating thing that I find with this, the response to this film. It seems, and this is a total reverse of the Speed Racer phenomenon, where all the old guard print critics trashed it, and the young internet critics have found merit in Speed Racer. It seems to be the total opposite, in that the young guard internet critics are really disappointed in the film, and kind of almost some are pretty angry at the film, while some of the old guard print critics have given the film pretty, you know, good note, you know, be it a B or three star. It's been a total, it's a total switch of the, it illustrates the generational gap in the movie critic community.
It surprised Chris. I think it surprised all of us too a little bit, the level of, let me say one thing, if the movie has one moment of joy for me, and it did, it had one genuine moment of joy for me, and I enjoyed the last half of it minus the last 10 minutes, actually. But if it had a moment of joy, it was his reaction shot when Karen Allen showed up. Just that 2 seconds of just his giddy reaction, I felt something like just for a second of invention, of something of the moment, and it felt alive. And actually, I laughed out loud at that part. I mean, that was a joyful part for me. We have a phone call, Anonymous. I don't know who you are because – Anonymous, hello.
Hello, this is Joel Valley. How you doing?
Hey,
hello?
Joel. How you doing, man?
Hey, Joel. What's up?
Good, good. I just wanted to call and give my opinion if you guys are willing to listen to it.
Oh, I want
to
hear it.
Go ahead, buddy.
I will say that it's not episode one. It's not.
No, it's got that going for it.
So, and I will, and I'm glad to say that the Temple of Doom won't be the ugly stepchild anymore. So that's good.
That's a bright spot. Yeah, that's.
I will say though, I mean, I think Chris's review is hilarious, but I don't think it was that. It was a very, very bad movie. I thought it had some good points. I almost walked out the first 15 minutes of the movie because the dialogue was so horrible.
But not even that.
Yeah.
You're just wondering when it starts.
Yeah.
And it felt like. I thought the first part of the movie was a joke. I thought that, like, Indiana Jones, they were filming a movie on his life, and I was waiting for, like, a fake director to come in and say, cut, and then the whole movie was going to start rolling.
That is so
funny. And it
fun
never
to
happened.
Say that,
no, go ahead, Chris.
I had the exact same reaction when that whole scene was going on. I didn't understand. I was looking around at the people with me, like, Are we fucking serious here? Like, because they were laughing and seemed to be enjoying themselves. I've heard a lot of people say they enjoyed the opening to this movie. Some of the guys on the show said that. I thought it was a joke. And the thing is, a lot of people, and you sound like you're kind of in the same boat with Jamie and Jerry, where, you know, you liked it okay, but you're a little bit disappointed with it. I really think the people in that boat, through the years, you're going to want to go back and watch the Indiana Jones movies, and then you're either going to not want to put this one in, or you're going to put it in, and you're going to be like, wow.
Who said
what?
I'm going to own this one?
That's a good point. Excellent point, Jerry.
It's going to come in a box, so you're going to get it. It's kind of like Alien Resurrection. You're going to get it if you buy the quadrilogy, no matter what.
Yeah.
Well, at least the Temple of Doom will get a little more play now, I think.
I think you're right.
People are going to put that in before. And you know what else I felt? I felt it was really closed in. Compared to other Indiana Jones, I felt like we were always on a set.
We were. Yeah, there's
like
an artificial nature to this one.
Yeah.
But I did have some fun. I will tell you, I had some fun moments, like the motorcycle chase scene. I thought that was fun.
Yeah, in the library, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that, I mean, there were some fun times. I want to defend this movie a little bit. Like, it was fun, but I do agree it was... It's not an indie movie.
Yeah.
But you're not going to remake Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. Aaron, what were you about to say?
The two chase sequences are really well staged. The motorcycle and then the long jeep chase through the jungle.
Aaron, they're not well staged. They're well recycled.
Yeah. A chase is not enough anymore, is it? I mean, is that enough for everybody? Is that enough for you?
No, they're just well recycled, I think, Chris, is what.
But it's a 15. There's a lot. There's like three levels of action going on there in that about 15-minute chase scene. That's pretty stunning.
Shitty.
You know what this lacked, though? It lacked that moment. You know that fight? You know the fight that Indiana Jones always has with the big guy? And he gets the pulp beat out of him, and at the last moment, he comes back and just whoops the hell out of him.
Yeah, it's
and
not
we,
there.
I didn't feel like that. That wasn't there, and that's what I loved about the indie movies.
That's the guy.
They tried to do it with the guy around the
that
ants.
That was horrible.
Yeah, with the mummy, where he pays homage to the mummy films with the ants? What was up with that?
But those ants were better than the ones in the mummy. I do want to say, I had the same
better ants.
I had
they have a good agent.
I had the same exact reaction that Jamie had when Indy sees Marion for the first time. And I actually had, I think there's even as good a moment or even a slightly better moment than that, and that is when they are in that truck and they're breaking out, and she goes, why didn't you settle down? And he says, they weren't you, honey. That is a great line, Reed.
That is a great line, and if only if it were wrapped up in a
better movie.
If actually it earned that moment, I think it would have even been better. But you know, Lawrence Kasdan wrote that line because David Koepp was struggling for a line like a zinger. He went back to the source, and Lawrence Kasdan came right up with it. Probably best line in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Thank you, Joel, for calling in Lion's Den.
Thanks for having me. I gotta ask
Chris
one question, and Chris, I love you, man. So I guess, you know, I'm just gonna go down. I'm just going down because I know you hate the film. So I'm just
gonna
go down the
list. You're gonna go down on Steven Spielberg. Is that what you were about to say?
No,
Damn, this is a family show.
I'm going down the list of stuff that I like that I want to see your counter argument. And I'm in the probably in the minority here because I've been a fan since 03, since Project Greenlight. I really had a lot of fun with Shia LaBeouf. Character. And just his performance. I just think it's a fun performance.
Okay, what do you think of Shia LaBeouf, Chris?
Yeah.
Shia LaBeouf as an actor. I've liked him against all odds in things that I've seen him in. I liked him in Transformers, which was a movie I hated. I thought he was the only thing that worked in it. I liked Shia LaBeouf. You know, he's the only thing I liked about Transformers.
Okay,
I didn't think
you liked anything, I mean, about that movie, so I'm shocked. Okay.
I like him. I think he's a good actor. And I think he works with what he can in the Indiana Jones movie, but it's just like Jamie was saying about the line to Karen Allen. The movie doesn't earn the level of emotion that it tries to throw down between Indy and Mutt, and
mm-hmm.
Mutt and Marion, and it doesn't earn anything. It doesn't earn any of it. It's just not. They try and build too much. And by the way, the end of the movie, there's like 7 or 8 people walking around with Indiana Jones. It's like the Indiana Jones gang, it should have been called, or something like that. An old bag of bones, John Hurt, just flying off of waterfalls.
Yeah,
John Hurt and Ray Winstone. I mean,
they're wasted
like,
in this film.
Yeah.
Everyone is wasted. How about Cate Blanchett?
I want to address that before we leave.
We didn't talk about it, but it's kind of embarrassing how she's used in this movie, isn't
it? Yeah. I'd like to address her for a second.
Please.
Go ahead.
I'd like
to do more than address her.
Well, I'm sure you do it. Okay. Well, I'm not going there. But I don't think this series, I like Temple Doom and Last Crusade a lot, but as far as villains go, this series hasn't had a better villain than Paul Friedman as Belloc. He was the greatest villain because he was his equal, but also so many steps ahead of him. And there's no one like that in this. I mean, Cate Blanchett just, she's like this like weird thing of like Lotta Lenya from Russia with Love and the character she played in The Good German, really.
Right.
You don't hate her the way you need to. The way you hated the Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark. There's just no hate there at all.
But as I was saying, go back to the point that I made, is that I think that we're entering into kind of more, in the setting it in the 50s, we're entering in more complex time. So I think this is part of Spielberg's tug of war with the story. And so he's not going to make an out-and-out villain. He wants to make a villain with a little more...
If that was true, Aaron, then it would be just like we were talking about earlier with the guest. You know, the villain gets annihilated at the end of this movie. So they're trying... I really don't think that that's what was going on here. I think that they thought they had a really good villain because they had a great actress playing her. I mean, if that was true, if they were doing this is she good, is she bad kind of thing, this ambiguous character... then she wouldn't be killed at the end of the movie in the way she is, and they wouldn't dwell on it like...
Which is a rip-off from the first film, too.
It's like Jerry was saying, Belloc, you wanted Belloc's face to be melted off at the end of the movie, it's like because you hated him so much.
Right.
Actually, I had a little more... I think Belloc was kind of the ambiguous character. The hateful character in Raiders, I thought, was always Tote. And for my money, the greatest villain in any of the indie films is got to be Mullah Rahm. That is a truly otherworldly villain. Mullah Rahm is just one of the great, great villains in any of...
Sorry, Aaron, I didn't know you were a racist.
What?
There's a lot about me you don't know.
Hey, maybe we should wrap this up, guys, because we've gone over...
Yeah, we have gone over.
Yeah.
But just in the sense, I've never bought in that Temple of Doom is an out-and-out racist film.
I'm just joking, Aaron.
Yeah, he's just joking.
Oh,
I think
he's joking. But I completely understand about the Blanchett argument, too. I mean, because Mullah Rahm is someone that, you know, abuses kids. I mean, how bad can you get?
Yeah, he would be on Dateline NBC now. That show on Dateline, he would be there, you know.
Yeah, and Cate Blanchett has perfect hair. That's her crime. Okay, guys, it's been a fun, spirited show, and I appreciate everyone's involvement.
Yeah, it was
great. We'll be back Wednesday night. Wednesday night, we have the director of the new horror movie called The Strangers.
Dude, that's going to be wild.
I'll be checking that out Tuesday night, so I'll actually be informed on that. It's going to be a great one. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.